Alaska Public Media presents Debate for the State. And now your moderator, Lori Townsend.
Good evening and welcome to Debate for the State for the U.S. House of Representatives. I'm Lori Townsend, News Director for Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Public Radio Network. We're coming to you live from our studios in Anchorage. Our debate, though, is a collaboration of all Alaska Public Broadcasting stations and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Our guests tonight are the candidates who have registered more than 5% in recent public opinion polls. Alaska's only seat in the U.S. House is currently held by Republican Representative Don Young. Mr. Young is seeking his 22nd term in Congress. Before going to Washington in 1973, he served in the Alaska State Legislature. Forrest Dunbar is his Democratic opponent. He's an attorney, an officer in the Alaska Army National Guard, a former Peace Corps volunteer, and he worked as a congressional intern and staffer. Libertarian Jim McDermott comes from Fairbanks, where he teaches in the School of Management at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He is a former director of the Fairbanks Small Business Development Center and retired from the U.S. Air Force. Joining me on our news panel is Liz Ruskin, Washington, D.C. correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network, and Dan Bross, senior news reporter for KUAC Public Broadcasting in Fairbanks. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
The rules of our debate are simple. We'll let you know how much time you have to answer each question. First, you'll see a yellow light letting you know that you have just a few more seconds to finish up your answer. When you hear this bell, time is up. I'll enforce this as politely as possible. Earlier, we tossed a coin, and Mr. Young won the right to answer the first question, and Mr. McDermott the second. You will have 45 seconds to respond. Let's start this round with a question from Dan Bross.
Mr. Young, as the most senior Republican in Congress, you have experience on your side, but you currently don't chair a full major committee as you have in the past. What recent accomplishment, demonstrates that you can still get things done for Alaska?
Well, I've passed more laws than any other congressman. In fact, the average congressman now has 1% of passing laws. And just past year, we have actually a book coming out. It says that I am the leader now of 4.13% of laws being passed, signed into law by the President of the United States. And I am chairman of the American Indian Alaska Natives, a very important committee. This is a committee that handles a large majority of our population in the state of Alaska, and one I believe is important for the future of the state and why I'm very proud to serve on that committee.
Mr. McDermott, as a libertarian, how would you find common ground with Republicans and Democrats to avoid being politically marginalized?
Great question. Well, first of all, let me just tell you a little bit about the Libertarian Party. We're very, very open-minded. So with that, social issues maybe to my left, financial issues a little bit to my right. So I think we would find it to be a really good mix, and we would probably be able to cross the aisle a whole lot more readily than we see right now going on in the United States Congress. I feel confident that I could work with either one of my colleagues at the table right now. Both of them, we were chatting before before this debate and talking about things as interesting as small business. So I just think it wouldn't be a problem at all. Actually, it would probably be a feather in my cap to have that role.
Mr. Dunbar, you're 30 years old, have never held political office before. It's a big leap to Congress. What specific experience do you have that qualifies you to be Alaska's sole U.S. representative?
Well, I think the most important thing about my background is I grew up in rural Alaska. I grew up in Eagle and Cordova. I had the opportunity to work as a commercial fisherman, as a deckhand, as a wildland firefighter. But then I had an opportunity that most people in my position don't get, which is to go to Washington, D.C., to live and work there, to intern and then staff on the Hill, and to build a network there that I could use on behalf of Alaska. I also have experience as a JAC officer in the Army National Guard. Veterans issues are very important to me. It's a job I know I can do well, and I could do well on behalf of the state. And it wasn't a decision I made lightly. I certainly had some sleepless nights before I decided to jump into this, but again, it's a position I know I could do and do well.
Thank you. Being a U.S. representative comes down to how you vote on legislation. In our next section, we have some questions for each of you about votes you might take. Liz Ruskin has our first question for Mr. McDermott. You will have 1 minute to respond in this round.
Yes. Do you support ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act? It would prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. It would apply to employers with at least 15 employees.
Again, there is some real blessings for being with Party and Party. And being here with the Alaska Libertarian Party, you will learn as you get more and more involved with the with our group, is that we're very, very pro and very, very diverse in our thinking about all these social issues, including the one you just brought up. I see no problems, and right down to the marriage of regardless of two people that love each other, I mean, across the board. We discuss in our circles is why is government so involved? I mean, these are things that people should be able to do freely. There should be no roadblocks, no hurdles. So yes, I would be quite an advocate on that particular program.
Mr. Dunbar, same question.
The answer is yes for me. I would support ENDA. I support adding sexual orientation as a protected category, as we have with race and religion. We have a group that has been historically discriminated against. I was disappointed to see that a similar motion, piece of legislation that went forward here in the state and in the city was not adopted. So I do think it's necessary. And of course, this is an issue that strikes home close to home for me. My sister is LGBT. She lives in Portland with her wife. I was supportive of these issues before we found out about that, but it certainly made me a little more emotionally connected to the issue. So yes, I would support and vote for ENDA.
And Mr. Young?
I have hired people of a different orientation. I've never looked upon a person as long as they can do the job, be whatever gender. So I think we're on the same wavelength, everybody at this table, other than the fact of the marriage. That's personal, and that's one wing I'll stick by. I do believe in the Bible. I always have and always will. And so consequently, but hiring is different. This is a different story. If I think a person can do the job, I'll hire them.
But this particular bill, sir, the ENDA bill?
Probably.
Okay.
Mr. McDermott, the federal minimum wage is currently set at $7.25 an hour. The Obama administration would like to increase that to $9. Should that be a decision that's made by the federal government, or should it be up to states? And what do you think the minimum wage should be?
No and no, not neither the state nor the federal government. I think the minimum wage it does more harm to our economics than it does as a plus. Let me just play off of that a little bit more. If we allow the free market, i.e. the free market in place to run free, oh gosh, or born free, but to run free, just think about the supply and demand. If there was a high demand for personnel to come work because the job market was so strong, the job rates, as far as being paid, would be extremely high. That's where our concentration should be. Not having a government mandate about how much a business needs to pay. It hurts the small businesses more than it hurts the big businesses by far. So what you end up doing is you have this real negative impact on the small businesses because they can't afford this. Walmart compared to a mom and pop retail, I mean, Walmart's not going to have any problem with $3 more an hour.
Mr. Dunbar, should the state or federal government set the minimum wage, and what should it be?
Yes, and I support ballot measure 3, the ballot measure on this year in Alaska to raise the minimum wage first to $8.50, then $9, and then indexed to inflation. And the reason is because I have to disagree with you, Jim, on this. You know, there is a lot of economic evidence that while the minimum wage and raising the minimum wage has a huge impact on poverty, it actually has very little impact on employment, and that is on increasing unemployment. Now, in theory, it should, and you could see why it sort of makes sense in the abstract. But we have a mountain of evidence of this. You know, I study economics and have a master's degree where I did a lot of econometrics, and this is one of the most studied topics in economics. And the data just don't bear out the theory that it should raise unemployment. The meta studies indicate that actually unemployment usually stays stable. If we can impact poverty in that way without reducing unemployment, I think we should. It's time the American middle class got a raise and the working class.
Mr. Young, minimum wage, who should determine it? What should it be?
I have supported minimum wage every time this came before Congress. I do believe, as Mr. McDermott has said, that the immediate effect may be evident, and the long-term effect is not so evident. I say this because if someone gets a higher wage, of course the person that's hiring them has to reach the profit motive or profit level, and he'll just raise whatever product they're producing. We do get a short burst, that's no doubt about it. It's ironic to me, though, that our poverty level has not decreased. It has, in fact, stayed pretty stable ever since Lyndon B. Johnson. Materially, people have more. But as far as buying power, they have less. And that is one of the things that concerns me. This is really much to do about nothing, but I've supported it every time it comes up, and we'll see what happens.
Let's move now to questions on natural resource issues. In Alaska, of course, we'll begin this section with Mr. Dunbar, asked by Liz Ruskin. You have 1 minute to respond.
Mr. Dunbar, allowing oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is popular in Alaska and extremely, or at least reasonably unpopular in Congress. It's opposed by members of both parties. Given Alaska's other priorities, how much political capital, if any, would you expend on trying to push an ANWR bill through in the next term?
I would expend quite a bit, actually. I think it's still an important goal for Alaska, and it's something I think we should be fighting for. I think we can do it in a way that satisfies multiple parties. So my biggest concern with developing ANWR is the food security of the Gwich'in people in that area. And the oil companies say that they can responsibly develop ANWR in a way that will not affect the caribou herd. So we need to write the law in such a way that holds them accountable, that does it in stages and says, if the caribou start to decline, we'll pull the plug. Basically, you know, like Ron Reagan said, right? Trust but verify. And that, I think, is an approach that could work. I think it's something you don't need to berate people on TV about it. I think it's something you can be more reasonable about. I will say that there are elements of the environmentalist movement in the Lower 48 for which ANWR is a talisman, and it's become separated from the science. But I'm hoping we can get the science back in there, be reasonable, and get ANWR moving forward.
Mr. Young, this is something you've worked on for years. How realistic do you think it is that you could get a bill in the next term?
I think it's very realistic if I'm reelected, when I'm reelected. I've done it 13 times. I know how to get it done. I actually got it out of the Senate once, and Bill Clinton vetoed it. Harry Reid is against it, 100%. Nancy Pelosi is against it. And the majority of the Democrats are against it. I made a coalition with the Democrats, and we've got it done, primarily out of Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, even Pennsylvania now. So I have the votes to do it, and we'll do it again. If Harry Reid is replaced, which I hope he is, we'll get a vote, and then we'll put it on the president's desk. This is good for the nation. It's good for the state. We have to look at this. It's not a new object. This is a project that should have been done a long time ago. It is a project that will take care of the wildlife. We saw what happened in Prudhoe Bay. We have more caribou there now than we've ever had before. There have been no disruption. In fact, they're more healthy now than they were before. This can happen, and of course, ANWR.
Do you have any the president would veto this bill?
I have no doubts he'd veto it, but then it's on his desk. That's one thing we'd like to do.
Thank you. Mr. McDermott, how much political capital would you expend on ANWR given the current political realities?
I think it would be more of my personal effort that I would put into it. Let me just bring this up again. As I would be the only libertarian in the United States Congress. But folks, Alaskans, listen to this. We've had Senate and U.S. House both controlled by the Democrats and the Republicans, and this issue has been kicked around over and over again. And here we are, 10, 15, 20, 25 years later, still nothing is getting done. So I would put the effort in, but I have to say, until we get more libertarians in office, it's going to be a little bit difficult to make that happen. Because, again, on the left and right, there's always a reason why it can't get done. I believe it should be opened up for exploration. I believe that, as I tell my business students, 99.9% of all business leaders want to breathe good air, they want to eat good food, they want to have healthy lands. So there's not people out there going out of their way to try to hurt our environment. And so with that, common sense needs to be an approach in Washington, D.C.
Mr. Young, Yukon and Kuskokwim River Chinook salmon have been depressed for many years. What should the federal government be doing to help the people that depend on those fish?
Well, the federal government, you know, what can they do? They are anadromous fish controlled by the state. But I have suggested respectfully that we as a state, and I will try in Congress to do, set up a salmon commission by each village on the river. Would have a vote on that commission because there's a dispute with the lower river and upper river now, who has access to those fish. And right now, there's some in the lower river want to have an economic and have a commercial fishery. That's unfair to the ones in the upper river. What I'd like to look at, because the lack of fish in that river are not because the people catching the fish. It's probably something at sea. Is it the temperature? Acidification? Is it maybe predators? We don't know. We're spending all our time studying onshore, then we should be looking offshore. This is the thing we should be doing. So what I'm going to suggest, and I'm with Dean Larson, or Larson out of Washington State, we have a what we call a Pacific Arctic Commission now. We're going to be looking at fish, and I'm suggesting the state they get involved more so, and this legislature has put money in the study, but I don't want them to study onshore, I want them to study offshore.
Mr. McDermott, same question. How should the federal government, or should the federal government be helping people who depend on those depressed Yukon and Kuskokwim Chinook stocks?
I'm glad you rephrased that just ever so slightly for me. That's good. Should they? Well, it should be limited at very much, and they being government, it should be limited. And here's what I'm thinking. I've talked with some of the federal government leaders in the SBA, and we talked about how by having an overabundance of regulations and policies in place that we don't have a diversified, in a lot of our rural communities, we don't have a diversified economic opportunities out there. So maybe that would be a start too. Yes, we can have some rules and regulations in place are going to be important, but does it need to be to the point where it drives the entire issue? I think it needs to be more diversified. I think more small businesses need to be brought into the community. I think the idea of how to be a small business owner needs to be brought into these communities, so the communities are more diversified and not relying on one industry. The rest of the country doesn't rely on one industry.
Mr. Dunbar, you're a former Yukon River resident with the continued depressed state of Yukon and Kuskokwim Chinook salmon stocks. What should the federal government be doing to help those people that depend on them?
Well, I have to. It's true that it's an economic issue, but it's much more than just an economic issue. It's also a cultural issue. You have people who have been living on that river, those two rivers, for thousands of years. And of course, my family didn't live there for thousands of years, but we came there and we saw people who were feeding their dog teams using fish wheels. Now, not enough fish always make it up the river. So it's more than just an economic issue, clearly. And I have to agree with the congressman. I think the idea of having commissions where everyone gets a seat at the table, everyone on the river, where they can speak and work together. This is an issue that came up at AFN. It's something that I think is a good idea and something that we need to do going forward. I will say I think the federal government's role also is to fully fund things like NOAA so that we can get more of that research. The state has a role there as well, because we have to know what is killing the fish. We don't really know, but it's a first order problem for everyone on that river, and it should be a primary concern for everyone in the state.
Thank you. Mr. Young, a lot of Alaskans, native, non-native, urban, rural, depend on fish and game to fill their freezers. Are all these subsistence users equal, or should there be a priority for some users?
Well, there is a rural priority. It's not native, it's rural. I put that in the bill. I do think that's very, very important. One of the things that disturbs me that under the Statehood Act, everybody has equal access to game. If it's utilized, I have a lot more sympathy for those that go out and do hunting and fishing. When it's not utilized and actually put in the dump in the springtime, that deeply disturbs me. I think the state has to look at the population. We've increased. When I first became a congressman, we had about 175,000 people. We got 730,000 people now. If we don't change how we manage game, we're not going to be successful having game for anyone. I have introduced the OTNA bill, which is co-management. It's understanding and allowing Alaska Natives to manage game with the state and have more input other than the federal government. And I think we ought to look at that, because if we don't, we won't have any fishing game.
Mr. McDermott, same basic question. When it comes to subsistence, should there be priorities for some users, and how should that work?
Again, I'm thinking of the thousands of Alaskans I talk to across the state, and this issue, it gets discussed in the sense that, are we showing favoritism at all from time to time? And the answer is yes, we are. If we have our hunting, we have. Do we put more of a priority in the state of Alaska on making sure that the game is available for tourists than we do our own people here in Alaska? And that's when I hear a lot of dissension, a lot of controversy when I'm talking with Alaskans. They, you know, so going back to what Mr. Young was talking about, I mean, where do you draw that line in the sand? That would be something I would sit down with the brightest people within our communities and do some brainstorming. I don't have the answer for you tonight.
Mr. Dunbar,
yes.
Same question. Subsistence users, should some be given a priority?
I believe passionately in a subsistence priority and for a rural priority. And I support Congressman Young's OTNA co-management bill. I think it's a very good piece of legislation. I think it's going to be a good pilot program and will let people who have been using those resources for thousands of years have a bigger role, a bigger seat at the table when these decisions are made. I will say, I also support a traditional use preference in cases where people have been using a fish camp, for example, for many generations, but they're forced into an urban area, say because of a sickness in the family or because the high cost of energy forces them out of the rural areas. They shouldn't lose their right to do that traditional harvest. That harvest is part of their culture that has been for however many generations. That's another thing that we, I think, we'll need to explore going forward and something that I would support.
Let's discuss foreign affairs now. This is an area that's dominating much of the news these days. Please keep your answers to 1 minute. Liz Ruskin will have the first question for Mr.
Point
Young.
Of information. That light is still 1 minute, is it not?
It is.
Okay, good. That helps us.
Well, actually, you'll have a few more seconds. That's giving you a warning that you're
okay.
coming up to the 1 minute.
Yeah,
when the bell rings, that's
it. I don't keep a watch. Go ahead.
Mr. Young, the beheading of Westerners by ISIS, is that the justification for our military involvement there, our military action against the group? What broader issues are at play in Iraq and Syria, and what's our best path forward there?
In 60 seconds is absolutely the right thing to do. We should be responded in a more definite way against ISA. ISA is a disease that's affected the whole area now. You see that we have Syrian troops now fighting ISA. We have, of course, the Kurd troops fighting ISA, Iraqian troops ISA. This is a different element we've had before. One of my frustrations is the rules of combat today. I feel sorry for our military people. They cannot, and you know, force is a JAG officer, but they cannot, in fact, return fire if there's a chance of collateral damage without possibly being in trouble. I mean, some people can shake their head. I've talked to too many troops that come back. So I'm going to suggest that we ought to be more forceful than we have to do. ISA is a danger to the Middle East and to the West. We're going to see a lot of this action, I believe, in the United States, especially rogues. That will happen. And we have to be prepared for that, and it is a challenge to all Americans and be quite aware of it.
What was it, the beheadings themselves, that justified our response?
I think it's not just the beheading, it's the aggressive amount they've gone into other countries. I think that's the main thing. I believe that shows that they're trying to take over and make an Islamic state in areas that are already Islamic without the Islamic in supporting that. And I think that is really our big challenge.
Mr. McDermott, the beheading of Westerners by ISIS, is that justification for U.S. military action there?
We're talking United States military, the most powerful military on the planet. So I'm kind of concerned. We as a nation talked about going into Syria back at the beginning of the year, calendar year, and I was opposed to that. And what were we doing? We were, from what I've been seeing in the news, we were supporting groups like maybe who were now connected with ISIS. Now they're the bad people, and now we're supporting the Syrians that we once wanted to go to war with less than a year ago. Perpetual war seems to be, right now, we have an appetite for it. I would rather see us not being involved in Iraq and Syria, and I just think we need to pull our forces out of that particular region.
Mr. Dunbar, same question.
So I was shaking my head. I think the congressman is a little confused about our actual rules of engagement, but putting that to the side, there is ample reason to go and seek out and destroy ISIS. There's no question. I was opposed to invading Iraq or going into Iraq in the first place. I think it was a mistake. I think looking back, it caused some of these latter issues. But we are where we are today. And frankly, the U.S. military saved our bacon. They were given an impossible task. They did as well as we could possibly have hoped. But the region has descended into chaos, and ISIS is a real threat. And so we are going to hunt down and destroy them with a combination of allies on the ground, with close combat air support, with shared intel, with limited use probably of special forces. But I am opposed to large-scale ground troops being sent back in. I think that is the wrong approach. I think that is not what the American people want right now. And it's something that we simply can't accept going forward. We can hunt down and destroy them without large-scale ground troops.
So chilling from 50,000 feet different?
I have a question now for all of you. I'll start with you, Mr. McDermott. How does or how should America balance freedom and security against the need to protect the country from terrorism?
Oh, good question. And again, I remind, as again in my circles and lots of great Alaskans, I have an opportunity to talk about this particular topic. One thing we like to talk about is that guy named Ben Franklin, right? He warned us. Ben Franklin said, hey, if we, and I'm paraphrasing here, Ben Franklin was saying, hey, if we sacrifice liberty for security, that in the end we're going to have neither. It's just the way it's going to be. So I would much rather see us set up a strong, you know, I'm the retired Air Force guy. I'd rather have a strong presence domestically, not all over the world, not in everybody's backyard. We have the technology to be anywhere we need to be in minutes. We can do it. We don't need to be in 300 different locations with our military forces. I would rather see us pull back. I was so glad to see the F-35s come up to the Fairbanks area, because they didn't need to be in Japan. They didn't need to be in Korea or in these other locations. And my light's on, so I guess my time's up.
Mr. Young, how do we balance freedom and security against the need to protect from terrorism?
Well, that's our biggest challenge. A lot of people hurt my, made me feel a little less sure of America when right after 9/11, a poll was taken and 72% of the people were willing to give up some of their freedoms for better security. That showed to me a lack of understanding that, just like Mr. McDermott said, they would lose both. And what we have to do is make sure our government doesn't, what I call, overreach, and they have done that. Taking my phone records, for instance, everybody at this table, taking those phone records and storing them, they said, we're not really affected, but we're going to store them. What for? If we go back through history, one of the reasons that Hitler was able to eliminate so many Jewish people was the fact that he had every name, every place. He knew exactly what to do. That's a big challenge. We think government should not be surveying and have surveillance over the common citizen of America, and that's dead wrong.
And Mr. Dunbar, the need to balance freedom, security against terrorism?
I think we have clearly sacrificed too much freedom in the last decade. The Patriot Act was, a large part of the Patriot Act was mistaken. Recently, CISPA, which allowed the federal government to access our internet records, and Congressman Young voted for CISPA. So, you know, it's always a balancing issue, but I would not have voted for CISPA. I thought it went too far in violating our individual freedoms. So it's always going to be a tricky issue, no question. And right after 9/11, there was the Patriot Act passed far too quickly. People didn't read it. Some people didn't show up to vote for it, and we just didn't think it through, and it went far too far in violating our individual freedom and our rights. And we need to be stronger as a nation, standing up for our personal freedoms and not giving in to the fear. That is how the terrorists win.
Mr. Dunbar, how do you think the U.S. government should respond to Ebola, both in West Africa and here in the U.S.? Do we have a responsibility as a world leader to send resources to the affected countries and balance that with addressing the issue here within our own borders, even if it's not as obviously as crucial as it is overseas?
We are one of the affected countries now, right? And we can see how, if we allow it to continue to fester in that region, it's going to come here, because we have a system now in the world where people are moving and traveling. If we don't spend at least some resources and don't spend at least some time trying to fight Ebola in West Africa, it's like they used to say about terrorism. We fight it there, so we don't have to fight it here, although we're fighting it here now too. But I will say a crucial point. Ebola is scary and it's dangerous, but the panic is worse in some ways than the disease right now. It's being driven by the news media. There's some sensationalism going on. We have competent doctors. We have some procedures. We have the United States military that is doing some work in that region as well. It's scary. We can do more, but the panic right now is more dangerous.
Mr. Young, how should we respond to Ebola, both domestically and overseas? Do we have a responsibility to help those countries?
I do think the CDC is doing a good job as far as quarantining. I'm not happy with the nurse. I think that's a very selfish step she's taken by not agreeing to be quarantined in her own house, in her own home. I understand the freedom aspect on her right, but let's say she does have it and she's infected other people. This is a very dangerous disease. As far as troops, the thing that bothers me about the troops, and I haven't checked this out, but I have somebody doing it now, were those troops asked to go, or were they told to go to fight Ebola? I think that's a great deal of difference. When you have a military force, you're trained to be a military person, actually to have a mission to defend this country. Did that include going over and handling Ebola patients? I doubt it. But again, if they volunteered, that's okay. But if they didn't volunteer, then I'm going to, that's the reason I say I'm having an inquiry now, were these troops aware and did they have a choice? That's something we have to look at. It is a dangerous disease. We have to quarantine when we can quarantine.
Mr. McDermott, the fight against Ebola, what should we do abroad and here at home?
You know, while I was in the military, I was trained, you know, in biological warfare, and just like my colleagues were. This Ebola situation is something that I never saw coming as far as a use for our military. It's just really caught me a little off guard in using our military in this way. If anything, the military is taking the right actions where when the people are coming back, they're being quarantined for 21 days. Let's ensure that we don't have this virus getting out into our general population. And I don't understand why this is such a difficult concept to do with the aid workers that are coming back from those same infected regions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. In case you're just joining us, this is Debate for the State for Alaska's seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. With us tonight are Congressman Don Young, a Republican, and challengers Jim McDermott, a Libertarian, and Democrat Forrest Dunbar. Our panelists are APRN's Liz Ruskin and Dan Bross from KUAC in Fairbanks. In this section of our program, the candidates will ask questions of each other. We have time for just one from each of you to another candidate. You'll have 1 minute to respond and a 30-second rebuttal if you choose. Mr. McDermott, you may ask the first question to either Mr. Dunbar or Mr. Young. Please keep your question short, up to, 20 seconds, succinct.
I'll do my best. Going with K through 12 public education, you're familiar with Common Core?
Are you asking?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. With that said, more federal government getting involved, even at the local levels. You said in the Juneau newspaper that you'd like to see more local government having say over their lives. Would that carry over to the K through 12 education system?
Yes, and thank you for that. Thank you for that question. I am opposed to Common Core. I think it was a flawed idea. We don't need it here. We don't want that one-size-fits-all approach here in Alaska. Alaska has unique challenges. I will say also I oppose No Child Left Behind, which Congressman Young voted for. That federalized education to a large degree. So I do want to see more local control. I do want to see us develop our own rigorous standards here in Alaska, because we know we have unique challenges in rural Alaska and in diverse school districts like here in Anchorage. So I do oppose Common Core. I don't think it's right for the state, and I think we can keep it out of the state.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Would you like 30 seconds to respond? Or?
Well, it seems like we're both fans, and I have to say I'm a little surprised with your overall response, but pleased. But with that, how do you feel then? Let me just add the tag along.
That's okay. I'll open it. I'll answer it if we can.
With the vouchers.
No, not another question.
But vouchers.
I do not support the voucher bill that was in Juneau this year. I don't think we should amend the Alaska Constitution that way.
Let's wrap this up. Mr. Dunbar, it's your turn now to ask a question. Please keep your question short and only one.
Sure.
And the candidate has 1 minute to respond. You'll have 30 seconds for a rebuttal if you choose.
Okay. This for Congressman Young.
No kidding.
So, Don, you stated that you're still influential and that you lost your chairmanships because of your party's rules and their term limits instead of your ethics violations. And even assuming that is true, can you honestly say to the Alaskan people that your ethics violations have not cost Alaska any influence in Washington, D.C.?
I can honestly say it has not cost any influence. We have been well received, as I mentioned before, that my ability to work in Congress and get achievements done is very, very evident. My members of Congress respect me for what I can do and how I represent this state. I was hoping, Forrest, you'd stay away from that subject because I've been found not guilty in every aspect.
You were rebuked summer.
Let him finish, please.
I was reproved by the Congress, was the least of all, and they will told you after I requested the information from the Ethics Committee. Where have I gone wrong? I do think I could have disputed, but I did say, okay, I follow what you've asked me to do. That was the gentlemanly thing to do, and I did pay. but that is not any type of reprimand of any type of any sort. So to bring that up is, again, you should be talking about how you could represent the people. How you can represent the people. That's what you should be doing. It shows your inexperience.
I get my
30
rebuttal.
Seconds,
yeah.
Yes.
So there was a time when Don Young was very powerful and very effective. He was the chair of the Natural Resources Committee. He was the chair of the Transportation Committee. He passed, at his height, 26 bills in 1 year. He was amazing. This past term, he's passed three. Five out of the Congress, every one that Nancy Pelosi voted for. So he doesn't have the same influence he once did. And he'll say it's because of party rules, it's not part of the ethics violations, but it happened at that same time. So it's a pretty remarkable coincidence. I don't think it passes the smell test.
Mr. Young, it's now your opportunity to ask a question. Please keep it succinct.
Well, it's the same type of question, Forrest. You previously said you would not vote for a fellow Democrat to elect Nancy Pelosi. If not her, who would you support, and how would you be an effective voice for Alaska as a freshman congressman in a minority party, which you will be, who has been just alienated himself from your own party leadership?
Well, thank you, Congressman Young. It's a great question. So I would not vote for Nancy Pelosi because I don't think she would be effective for the state. And before I voted for anyone for the leadership of my party, I would ask them critical questions like, do you support the road to King Cove? How do you feel about development on the North Slope? And we would have leverage there. We would. So I think I can be effective. And I think Lisa would make the argument that despite the fact she's been in the minority for the last 8 years, she still has done good things for the state by being bipartisan, by working across the aisle, by reaching out to people in the Senate, in the House, in the administration. I think we can get things done. And I think also the style that you used to use so effectively, which was sort of bombastic, and you said it yourself, you know, you sort of berate people, that works when you were the party chairman, but you're no longer the chairman. And so when you do that on TV, I think it's counterproductive, and I think we could take a more effective approach. Alaska needs more ethical and effective representation in Congress.
30 seconds, sir.
Good answer, Forrest, but dead wrong, and you know it. If you vote against Nancy Pelosi, you won't even have an office. I've been there before and I've seen what happened when they voted against Boehner. I know exactly what Nancy would do. As far as being effective, I still passed more laws than both of our senators have done this past 2 years. And that means that a chairman like Mr. Begich has been chairman for 6 years, hasn't passed any bills but one. Don't interrupt me.
Sorry.
You know that. Shame on you. But the fact of the matter is I've been rated by two professors as the number one effective legislator. And I want you to get this book. This is for the media. This is a good book, and I can show you where it is right here. So
you
don't want to read that.
Let's go. I don't have time right now. Let's go now to questions affecting the U.S. domestic agenda. Liz Ruskin will have our first question to Mr. Dunbar. Again, you will have 1 minute to respond.
Yes, this is about healthcare. Surgeries and medicine cost much more in the U.S. than in Europe and most other countries. The Congressional Budget Office has said that if medical costs continue to grow, total government healthcare spending could soon account for the country's entire economic output. Mr. Dunbar, how can Congress bring down the cost of healthcare delivery?
That's a great question. And we're seeing it reflected also in our insurance premiums. The good news is, in the last several years, we've seen a decrease. It's still increasing, but it's increasing at a slower rate. And we're not sure exactly why that is. Some people say it might be because of the Affordable Care Act. Some say it's because of our economic downturn. Hopefully that's not the case. But clearly, this is a large priority for the Congress, but also here in the state. Here in the state where it's so difficult and expensive to deliver specialty care, to the point where people are flying to Seattle, sometimes with their family, staying there for 2 weeks, and it's still cheaper than getting a surgery here in Anchorage. So it's a first order priority, it absolutely is. And we have to look at perhaps changing our regulations if those are driving the cost, changing our taxes if those are changing the cost, maybe moving away in some cases from our fee-for-service system if that is what is driving the cost. But I do think we can make some progress here, and we have to make it, especially here in the state of Alaska. It's not just going to be a federal issue. It's going to be very much an Alaskan state issue as well.
So do you have ideas why it's so expensive here and what we can do?
It's very difficult. It's very difficult to recruit and retain high-quality medical professionals up here. And that is, you know, one of the things we need to do and try to do is develop a med school here and expand our teaching hospital program, because there are plenty of studies that show that where they do their residencies, where doctors and other professionals do their residencies, that's where they tend to live and stay. We need to increase the supply of medical professionals here in the state. Hopefully that'll bring down some of the costs.
So med school. Mr. Young, what can Congress do to bring down the cost of health care delivery?
I think Congress's costs cause a lot of this problem. If you want to mess something up, get Congress involved in it. I would suggest respectfully a lot of this is regulations, requirements by the medical field to do things that are unnecessary for good medicine. The high cost of drugs, which I do believe is sometimes out of shape, they should be generic instead of the trade names. A lot of requirements for the professional field itself. As far as I'm concerned, Alaska has some of the best professional doctors and nurses in the United States. It is higher to take and give service here in Alaska. We have other things that occur, heating cost, wages. Everything raises that rate, so you might be able to go to the lower 48. But as far as being able to do the job, we have good medical fields in Alaska. Now, I would suggest another thing, what we have to look at is the ability to have sub-clinics or have outside units instead of going through a hospital. Hospitals are very, very expensive. They can you do the same type of surgeries out on an out clinic? Probably it would be much more reasonable. Now, that's up to the market. I happen to agree with Mr. McDermott. We'll get involved in this, like we wrote the Nancy Pelosi health care bill. It's not Obamacare. We actually wrote that bill, and we didn't know what was in it, and it's raised the cost.
Thank you. Liz?
Mr. McDermott, do you have any solutions as to how to address the high cost of health care in the U.S.?
Well, we've heard some good ideas already bantered about, which I agree with. One that's new for me, though, I love the medical school idea. Actually, being a university professor, though, I have a bias, so I'm just going to let that get out there. I think that's a good thought process, because that is one of the reasons our costs are so high. But, of course, a lot of your for-profits are taking advantage, and maybe there could be additional creativity going with this process where we have traveling nurses and traveling doctors. We see it in foreign countries. Maybe we can see it a lot more here in Alaska and different incentives that will be put in place to help drive the cost down for Alaskans. It is extremely high. It's outrageous. And even for the insurance itself, I work at UAF. It's a great school. And I'm concerned, and a lot of my colleagues are concerned, are we going to be paying additional costs and taxes because we're going to have this Cadillac, or at least perceived to be a Cadillac type of medical process. So, a lot of these things need to be approached in the United States Congress, maybe more than anything, to get them out of the way. Going back to the patent system he was talking about, maybe re-engineering the patent system a little bit where it's a little bit more friendly with the patent life cycles that are now established with the medicines.
The U.S. military accounts for a large part of federal spending, $756 billion, it's second only to Social Security. Given the changing spectrum of threats facing the U.S. and our growing debt, how should we prioritize military spending? What items, and we'll start with you, Mr. Dunbar, in the military budget, how should they be priorities? What should get more, what should get less?
Sure. Well, Alaska, the good news for Alaska is that we have a unique geostrategic position. That's going to allow us to keep our bases open and keep more forces here, especially as the U.S. military starts pivoting to Asia. But there's no question. I mean, I speak with some commanders, probably not as high level as Congressman Young gets access to now. But everyone understands in the military that they have to start living within their means, that some of these programs are going to have to be reduced. And some of the weapons programs that were extremely expensive. Another example is we kept making M1A Abrams tanks, even after we didn't think we could get them over to Afghanistan, or we maybe didn't even need them. But Congress, and don't want to get too specific, but basically Congress knew that it's good jobs in certain districts, and so they kept foisting these tanks upon the military, thousands of which end up just rusting out. So trying to prevent Congress from forcing the military to take that kind of spending is going to be a big step. But there's no question that we are going to see also a reduction in number of troops. That's going to be a reality. But we have to do what we can to preserve funding for troops, salaries for troops, and particularly medical care before and after.
What about the big elephant in the room, missile defense?
Missile defense is going to continue to go forward. The research is going to continue to go forward, and Congress has placed some of those installations here in Alaska, and I would continue to fight for those as well.
Okay. All right. Mr. Young, what about prioritizing military spending given the current climate, looking at the threats that face us and our budget situation? How do you prioritize military programs that should be funded at their current levels, maybe higher and some less?
Well, number one, the missile defense system in Alaska I put in. And this is one of the things I'm quite proud of. They were going to brac that field down at Greeley, and we got involved and we put it in there because I believe that's the future. I also would like to suggest something new. I'd like to have, and I will introduce a bill called the conflict tax. Because when we as citizens do not become directly involved, and only those that serve and the families of are involved, we're not really aware of the money being spent. But if we had a conflict where a president says, oh, we're going to go into Syria, we're going to go into wherever it is, we have to take and fund it as we go along instead of putting ourselves in debt for the future. This is what should be done. We'd have more awareness. We'd be more knowledgeable of what's happening. And we can take and decide whether we want to increase the military or decrease the military than allowing that decision to be made by the Pentagon and the president. This would be, again, the people's army. And that's something that's very dear to me, that we understand how we invest in these type of conflicts if we're going to do it.
Okay, thank you. Mr. McDermott, military spending priorities, what are they given the current budget climate and the threats that we face?
Some good ideas I've already heard at the table. But let me just throw this out there. One of the things I've heard that's going to be cut, or at least was being discussed, was the commissaries, where the military families go and buy their grocery food and their groceries at. And of course, I just get a brain freeze just thinking about that's going to be what we're going to cut instead of tanks that we don't need that go around in circles. I'm talking about they were designed poorly. But with that said, I want you to also think about the madness with how, if you come under budget in the military, if I'm a department head and I come under budget at the end of the year, I'm penalized. You see, going into the next fiscal year, I'm penalized for coming in under budget, which means I start the next year with that under budget level, where whatever I didn't spend, that's just taken away from my budget right from the get-go. Never mind ads, it's taken away. It's a crazy thought process. What we need to do is put incentives in place where we give our military leaders, good managers, reward systems in place for coming in under budget versus, you know, penalizing them. So that's just one of many, along with not closing the commissary and along with not poorly designed equipment. I had three more things, but okay.
Mr. Dunbar, what changes would you like to see in national fisheries law with the renewal of the Magnuson-Stevens Act?
Sure. Let me just respond quickly. It's a great tank. Plenty of them already.
Okay.
I don't think we need large-scale changes to Magnuson-Stevens. We're going to try to reauthorize it and bring it forward. I know it's a priority for Congressman Young as well and for our Senate delegation. It seems to be working well. We have one of the best managed fisheries in the whole world that provides a tremendous amount of wealth in this state. $5.8 billion in some cases, 78,500 jobs. And a large majority of that is from federal fisheries that comes because of the American Fisheries Act, because of Magnuson-Stevens. So again, I don't think large scale changes are necessary. We need to make sure it goes forward largely how it is now and preserve power and authority in the Fisheries Council, because they're doing, at this point, a fairly good job in managing that fishery.
Thank you. Mr. McDermott. Changes in the Magnuson-Stevens Act?
Again, it always comes back for me where we get too many policies, too many regulations, too many rules that are in place that just seem to limit our capabilities to be much more diverse in our communities within Alaska. We get tied into oil. We get tied into the fish industries. We just get tied into limited topics. And I really believe what we need to do here in Alaska is to start thinking outside of the box, in the sense that what can we do to develop more industries? And in particular, what can we do to entice, well, starting off with the medical school. I know I'm getting a little offbeat here, but these are good ideas. I mean, these are the type of things we need to be looking at and bringing into, you know, more research facilities, more, you know, the missile defense is great. Yeah, it brought in a lot of jobs, but we need to diversify more and more and not just get locked into oil and the fish industries. There's more to Alaska than that.
So you don't see any changes in the
MSA? I'll live with what we have for now, maybe less intrusion with regulations and policies and government.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Young.
You know, as the father of the Magnuson and Stevens Act, it should have been named the Young Studs Act because Gary Studs and I wrote it. It started in the House, it passed the House, and then it got over to the Senate, and all of a sudden it got a big boost over there, and it became the Magnuson-Stevens Act. It has worked well. We're fine-tuning that bill right now. If it does become law this lame duck session, which there's a very slim chance, I will probably be in charge of that bill when I'm reelected. So I'm going to look at it again and add suggestions. But again, this is a bill that's worked very well. I'm very proud of that bill. It started in Kodiak, and we finished it, and it's given us the follow-up of CDQs, community development quotas for the regional, the villages along the coast. Been very successful, very, very much economically rewarding. And we're managing our fisheries now, not only with the council, we have an Alaskan fishery because of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, really the Young Studs Act.
So other than changing the expiration date, is there anything you would change?
There's some changes already taken place. We're trying to get more representation on the council from subsistence users. Somewhat difficult because of the Seattle-based group that council members down there don't really like that, but I'm going to work on that and see if I can get it done. But overall, it's been a great act, and we have managed our fisheries better than any other council around the United States.
The federal gas tax that funds transportation projects has been stuck at 18 cents per gallon for 20 years. Mr. McDermott, should we consider increasing that tax, or do you have other means for funding transportation projects?
Gosh, you keep coming back to it, and knowing my answer for big government is much more limited and leaner government, along with the diversity. So no, lowering would be my preference. So let me follow up with your question.
How do we fund transportation projects, roads, bridges?
Well, again, I know this is going to be hard to believe for some, but there has been private industries that have put in roads and bridges, railroads. Yeah, you should look at our American history. It's been pretty incredible where we've had business leaders that have actually put these in place. What happens is we have so many laws and regulations in place. Now we make sure that government makes sure that we do their absolute best that we can't get roads put in by, let's say, a business, and they make it very difficult where we have to go through a lot of different permitting systems and a lot of different hoops that we have to jump through. So, yeah, I have a feeling if we allowed business to flourish, life would be a whole lot better than we're looking at it right now.
Mr. Dunbar, should Congress increase the federal gas tax to pay for transportation infrastructure, or do you have another solution?
No, they should not increase the federal gas tax, and I don't think any representative from Alaska is likely to support that, given the fact that we already have crushing cost of energy in Alaska. You go to Dillingham, you go to Bethel. I've been to all these places during the course of this campaign. It was very important to me to get off the road system. There's a temptation to stay in Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, where we're doing these campaigns. But I grew up in rural Alaska, where the cost of energy is higher. And traveling around the state, it's one of the first things you hear. You know, gas is $7, $8, $9, sometimes $10 a gallon or more in some of these villages. So I would not support increasing the federal gas tax. In terms of funding our transportation projects, there might be cases in Lower 48 where we could use user fees. But I think in general, we've been able to fund our transportation projects in the past, and we should continue to do as we have done. And it's unfortunate that some of these things have become very controversial and very partisan, and we see this abuse of the filibuster in the Senate and things like that. But no, I do not support increasing a federal gas tax.
Mr. Young, you're a former House Transportation Chair, and we know you support the gas tax increase. How much do you think it should, where do you think it should be, and why?
I wanted 5 cents and index it, and not to support that is not having a transportation system. Someone has to pay for it, and we can't take it out of the general treasury now because we're $18 trillion in debt, $7 trillion in debt in the last 6 years, if you want good roads. The idea that we're not going to have roads is something the public will have to finally accept if they don't want to pay for it. I argued if you had 5 cent tax when I was chairman, that's what I wanted. I got reprimanded by the president, President Bush, and the legislative body, and right now I'm having very strong support from the Democrat side. Not much support from my side, but if you want a good system, you have to have it. As far as high cost, we could use this just for highways. Those that drive on the highways would have to pay that tax or a user fee of some sort. That would be the system, and we have to do it if we want to compete against the global economy. You have to have a transportation system. So I would vote, and I'd put it at 5 cents, one time, 23.2, and index it, and it'd solve the problem.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, so much. We're just about out of time, but I just have one quick thing to ask. What's been the most entertaining or fun thing that's happened on the campaign trail? Very quickly.
Fun thing?
Mr. Young.
Talking to Forrest Dunbar.
Thank you, John.
Mr. McDermott.
Sharing the experience with my family. It's been a lot of fun. They've been very supportive.
And Mr. Dunbar.
I had a chance to speak at Begich Middle School, and one of the students challenged me to a game of one-on-one basketball, and we couldn't do it that day. But the next day, we went back, and I played him one-on-one. And that was just, with all the students there, and that was just the most fun I think I've had.
I won't ask about who won. That is all the time that we have for tonight's 2014 Debate for the State for U.S. House. Our thanks to Don Young, Jim McDermott, and Forrest Dunbar, as well as our panelists for participating. Please stay with us. Debate for the State will continue in just a moment with candidates for the U.S. Senate. Oh, right.